Today we have an informational meeting, and just so the committee will know what's been placed before them, we have the economic and revenue forecast is at your chair today, as well as you'll see a memo here that talks about what the presenters at today's meeting were asked to provide some certain information regarding our current economic situation, the business cycle, and our long-term economic prospects. Mr. Anderson was asked to join us today. He could not, but he did provide answers to those particular inquiries. So that is presented for your information, understanding. We are pleased, very pleased, to have Bill Connerly, Jim Johnson, Tony Ruffalo with us. I don't see Mr. Nguyen presently, who we expect or have expected to be here. But we are thankful to these gentlemen for coming. Last Friday, we heard from Mr. Patowski, his forecast, and of importance, I think, to this committee, not only his long-term outlook, but his projection of a growth rate of approximately 11% for the biennium. I'm not sure whether or not these gentlemen will subscribe to that particular figure, but we'd be very interested in their prognosis of our economic future as we try to determine what level of expenditure is appropriate in this committee. So with that, gentlemen, if you would mind coming forward to the witness stand in whatever order you care to proceed is fine with this committee. So I'd like to... Mr. Connerly, you've got the front and center. Welcome. Thank you all very much for being here.
Good morning, Representative Miller and members of the committee. I'm Bill Connerly from the principal and only person in the consulting firm Connerly Consulting, LLC. I have arranged my comments in terms of a handout, what's wrong with the economy, the forecast, the revenue system, and what to do about it. I think in so doing, I will hit the questions that have been addressed, though this does give me an opportunity to slide by the most difficult ones if I can put it over on you. Let me quickly summarize what I've concluded and then do questions. What's wrong with the economy? First of all, understand the context. Oregon is more dependent on manufacturing activity than the average state. And within manufacturing, we're more dependent on capital goods, the kinds of stuff that businesses buy as long-term investments, than we are on manufacturing consumer goods. So when the auto industry does well, the home appliance industry does well, that doesn't mean much for Oregon. But when businesses are expanding their capacity, their information technology system, buying trucks or rail cars, then Oregon does well. And you can see the chart there on page one, what happened to orders for capital goods over the last few years. We've had a colossal drop in this sector of the national economy. So you have a state more dependent on capital goods than the average state, and capital goods goes into the tank. We pretty much have to go into the tank. It's like almost mathematically deterministic. So the problem stems from the national economy. We're not going to find economic development efforts solving this problem. It's always a good time to improve the business climate, and I wouldn't discourage you from thinking about what creates a good environment for new jobs, but that's advice I'd give at any time. And the cyclical downturn we're in is not going to be reversed through any effort towards economic development or changing business regulations or taxes. So think of that as a long-term effort, but not the short-term fix. What's wrong with the forecast?
Can I interrupt for a question from Senator George?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Bill, you just mentioned the taxes, but wasn't there a substantial adverse effect as we witnessed during the 80s when we were one of 10 states that raised taxes the most, and we were one of the 10 states that were the longest in the recession last recovery? Do you think there's any relationship between increasing taxes and recovery?
Representative Miller and Senator George, there's a connection, but it is a relatively slow connection. And the shape of the short-term cycle is not heavily determined by our tax policy. Whether we decide to, say, lay off state workers or raise taxes, both of those are negative. I will say that tax policy does have a long-run effect. It's a small effect that accumulates and compounds over time. And in that regard, there's been a study done of migration within the United States. And states without income taxes have been receiving people from states with income taxes. There's been a net migration, and people are voting with their feet to go to states with a different kind of tax structure. Now, our underlying growth has been strong enough that we haven't felt that fully, but it's there.
Thank you. Proceed, all right. Please.
What's wrong with the forecast? I'm on page 2 there. The revenue streams that we're trying to forecast are very, very volatile. The top chart shows personal income tax revenue before kickers and pension refunds. And, you know, it looks like it's cruising along, and then suddenly, boom, it hits. This is just very difficult to forecast. And let me add that, and then look at capital gains income. That is a forecasting challenge. Capital gains realizations happen when people have investment assets, stocks and real estate, at a gain, and then they choose to sell them. Now, even if you could tell me what the stock market was going to do, I would be challenged in telling you to what extent people are going to sell their stocks and real estate at a profit versus just hold on to them and let the investment ride. And that would be difficult if you could tell me what the stock market is going to do. And I don't think anybody can tell me what the stock market is. So we've got two really challenging problems in getting at capital gains. And the corporate income tax is shown on the third page. Again, a tremendous amount of volatility. Some years, 25% gains in there. And, of course, the huge drop in 2002. That's an estimate. We don't have final returns there. So we've got some inherently volatile streams. And we have this offsetting challenge. The corporate profits are the most volatile part of overall national income. Within personal income, things like capital gains and bonuses, stock options, proprietors' income are the most volatile parts. And as somebody says, gee, we need to shift the tax burden to the rich, you're going to be shifting the tax burden to a more volatile revenue stream. If you say we want to go to more stable revenue streams, you're going to be shifting the tax burden on lower income people. It is not an easy choice for you to make.
Senator Gordley, a question?
Thank you. And I'm sorry to stop you in midstream here, but could you define how you're using the word volatile so that I have a better understanding of what you mean?
Sure. Okay. Senator Gordley, Representative Miller. When I say volatile, I mean something that is prone to very large swings, can go up quite suddenly, can go down quite suddenly.
I'm looking for something a little deeper than that. You said the corporate tax is subject to more volatility because...
Okay. Well, let me just make a historical statement. If you look at, say, 30 years of data, and you look at the average percentage change without regard to whether it's up or down, you see much bigger year-to-year changes in corporate profits than you do in wage and salary payments.
Okay, we're still not getting at it, but continue.
Matt, I think I understand what your
Thanks.
Question is. Mm-hmm. If you look at what we tax for the corporate sector, we tax their profits. And profits
Ruffalo,
are the different...
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Tony Ruffalo, Portland State University. Well, in the corporate sector, we tax profits, which are the difference between revenue and cost. So slight differences in either revenue or cost can affect that margin very substantially, whereas in the personal sector, we tax all income. And the difference in terms of volatility, then, is this all income versus the difference between revenue and cost.
Mm-hmm. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. The revenue for, let me make a couple of comments on the revenue forecast process, if I may. The revenue forecast consists of two parts, a forecast of the economy and then a forecast of the connection between the economy and revenue. Currently, the economic forecast gets the most attention. from the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors and from an insider recruit. It's called the Insiders Group. I don't know if there's an official name. That's economists working in various arms of the state government who meet to review the forecast. And these two groups have traditionally focused on the economics, and we pretty much have left it to the state economists to work on the connection between the economy and the revenue. I believe that the biggest forecast errors we've made have been in that connection between the economy and the revenue rather than getting the economy right. Not to say we've gotten the economy right, but I think that this is a gut feel. I haven't seen hard numbers on it, but I think that our understanding of what drives revenue given a particular economic scenario is much weaker than our understanding of what drives the economy. And this has been discussed in the Council of Economic Advisors, and the state economist has said we're going to be spending more time talking about a revenue connection and work on that a little bit. The last point I'd like to make on the forecast process is I see a lot of attention to the final number, but not as much attention to the uncertainties associated with it. And if you go through the revenue, the forecast document, if you actually read the words, there will be phrases like, gee, could go up, could go down. And I have found in my professional career that some of the most things that I thought were most useful were not presenting a forecast, but talking about where I have confidence and where I don't have confidence. As a forecaster, there will be times when I'm pretty confident I've got this thing bracketed. And other times, I'm giving a number because I'm asked to give a number, not because I really have any belief that I can forecast that. And I would encourage members of the legislature to look at the revenue forecast in terms of where is their confidence and where is their not confidence. So that is kind of what's wrong with the economy, what's wrong with the forecast system. Let's talk about the revenue system. We have, and I'm on page 4, we have unstable revenues, but we want stable spending. That's a challenge. Secondly, there are games, I call them biennial games, but I'm sure you can tell more about this than I can, where if you want a new program but it looks too expensive, let's not put it in for the whole biennium, let's just slide it in the last 6 months, and that just creates problems for the next biennium. This is the next biennium. Those problems have accumulated. And then I have a lot of fine print on the slow adjustment. And the problems that the state of Oregon are facing are partly due to forecast errors and partly due to very poor adjustment to changing conditions. 2 years ago, when I testified before this committee, I said, hey, there's risk of recession, and I recommended having a higher than normal ending balance. Mm-hmm. Now, I have a lawyer friend whose investment philosophy is listen to the economist and do exactly the opposite. And apparently the legislature shares that view.
Representative Morgan, a question or a comment?
Could you talk to us about what you see what is a high ending balance in your estimation?
It would be, Representative Morgan, I haven't looked at the sort of historical range, but I would want to say 5% or so.
Okay.
And that's sort of a gut feel.
Historical range of about
2.10. So, may I follow up, Mr. Cook, here? 5% of the total budget or 5% of the general fund, or what are we talking?
Yeah, I would say 5% of the total budget would be reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Thank
you. Let me add in that regard that if you budget conservatively in one biennium, the next biennium you have all of your ending balance to spend, and then you can be conservative with the forecast. You don't take an ongoing hit, you just take more or less a one-time hit of putting some money aside. But in any event, we passed a budget with a very small ending balance. The September 1st, 2001 revenue forecast, 3 months into the biennium, put the state budget in the red. The forecast was for a deficit. The reaction to that, I remember, was, hey, it's a small deficit. Things may get better with the December forecast. Yeah. At the time, I thought that was a rational, prudent response, September 1st. after we dealt with the emotional and human losses of September 11th, it became clear that the forecast was not going to get better between September 1st, 2001, December 1st, 2001. In that period of time, though, the state continued to add employees, not just replace retirees and quits, but we hit an all-time record level of state employment in January of 2002. We then started the special sessions. The governor didn't order the hiring freeze until June of 2002. Then, of course, you know about the tax referral. Basically, at a time when the private sector was just hitting the brakes very hard and making very rapid decisions to do hiring freezes and cutbacks, the state was deliberating. Now, as a citizen, I like the idea of the state deliberating, a process where different opinions are considered. But if we're going to have a slow, deliberative process, you need more cushion for these sudden changes. If I were talking to an organization that prided itself on being able to react very quickly to external events, I would say have a small cushion. But an organization that moves slowly and deliberatively needs a larger cushion. So I think that's part of the problem with our revenue system. What do we do, finally, I'm on page five, what to do about Oregon's problems? The biggest issue is waiting for the national recovery. I am expecting the national recovery to strengthen this year. We have had five quarters of rising output.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Senator Winters.
I can jump in and ask a question. When you're talking about waiting for the national recovery, and I'm sure that there's some historical data that suggests how long is it following the national recovery that we begin to really rebound? 2 years, 3 years?
Yeah. Representative Miller and Senator Winters, that is a variable number. We had a relatively slow recovery after the 1991 recession, took a couple of years, and we're seeing the same thing now, but the historical pattern has been for a faster turnaround. That was the case in 82, 83, after the 73, 75 recession. And I think the difference is that traditionally, housing starts turn up early in the recovery, and in the past recessions, we were very dependent on the wood products industry. This cycle, we're more dependent on capital goods, and historically, capital goods is always very slow to recover. Businesses want to be really sure they need to add capacity before they do that. So I think an element of the changing structure of the Oregon economy is that we will see that we lag coming out of recessions more than we have in the past.
I just needed to have that out there because there's some who might think we're going to recover fast, right, like we did when we did have the timber industry and others. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I might add, if we started recovering rapidly today, it would not be a fast recovery because we've already gone five quarters with negligible growth. But we primarily need to wait for the national recovery. I think that we are going to see a gain nationally in employment and capital spending starting sometime this year, whether it's next month or the end of the year, I'm not sure. I am crossing my fingers increasingly about the negative effects of the Middle East situation. Rising oil prices are not good for the economy. And I am right now dialing up, in my mind, the risk of a double-dip recession, the risk that we go into a second round. I think if the war is and uncertainties associated with it are concluded rapidly, I'll feel very comfortable about my optimistic forecast. But if the uncertainty persists, if our military involvement becomes more like Vietnam or the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, then I'm going to go into a more pessimistic forecast. And I think in the coming months, I would recommend that you not completely buy into the optimistic forecast, but hopefully before this session is over, we'll know whether that optimistic forecast is justified. My next recommendation is listen to the cautions and uncertainties as well as the numbers.
Bates. Dr. Connolly, there's been discussion recently in the press and various talk shows about the high cost of fuel right now.
actually causing a double-dip recession a year to 18 months from now. If this is going to continue, this high cost, it's going to ripple through the economy and has a chance of that alone dropping us back into recession if this isn't resolved as a result of the situation in Venezuela. And that would be worse than anything that happened in the Middle East. If you put that into your mind of maybe we've already done the damage to the economy and we are going to face another recession in a year or 18 months from now?
Yeah, I've looked at every past period of oil price increases and energy cost increases, and what I have seen is that it's not enough by itself to push us into recession, but it is enough if there are other things going on to push us over the edge. And so where we have had the worst effects of rising oil prices has been when we had an economy that was feeling higher interest rates, the Federal Reserve tightening, and then, boom, the higher oil prices just kind of do it. But we have had occasions with rising oil prices that were not associated with a recession following. So the energy costs are a negative, but by themselves, I doubt that they would be enough to push us into recession.
Senator Gordley has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and co-chairs. As we proceed, I'm just wondering if we're also going to hear an opinion that would be contrary to what we're hearing now, so that we can truly weigh pros and cons of these arguments. Is there an opposing view?
I haven't written their testimony, so I can't forecast.
I'm just wondering. Would like to hear him spoken to.
Oh, well,
it's entirely possible, but we don't know.
Ham Nguyen, Portland General Electric Company. My apology to the chair, co-chair, and the rest of you. I was having some problem with the car. Anyway, my view is not to really contradict what Bill has to say. Working in the energy industry for quite a number of years.
Mr. Nguyen, we're not quite ready for your whole testimony here. I think we were going to go in the...
My apologies.
No problem. Are you...
I'm nearly done.
Close to conclusion.
So I think that we need to wait for the national recovery. Listen to the cautions on uncertainties, and then in terms of the entire revenue system, we've got this mismatch between unstable revenues and a desire for stable spending. One opportunity is to shift to a more stable revenue stream. If we do that, it will probably be a more regressive scheme. I don't know a way to get stable revenues from a highly progressive tax structure. Maybe somebody's cleverer than I do, but than I am, but I don't know it. Another option is to learn to save. The saving is where you don't spend all the money that you have available to you. I suggested.
Thank you.
I hope I'm not.
That was a little
concept
too fast.
We're not familiar with.
We wouldn't know.
What
was that again?
In, I believe, 1999, I was discussing the idea of a rainy day fund with a member of the legislature who said, Bill, it is raining right now, in 1999. And at the time, it felt rainy, given budget limitations, Measure 5, many needs that we feel in the community. But we now know it was not raining in 1999. And that's the challenge with learning to save. Oklahoma does things such as they, in a given year, budget. I may not have the number right, but I think they budget 96% of the previous year's actual revenue, plus anything they have left over from the previous year where they had constrained their budget. And they're having some challenges this round because they, like us, are dependent on an income tax and capital gains, but their challenges are not nearly of our magnitude. A third approach is just to accept unstable spending. And when you're at the peak and you have a lot of money, try to use that money for one-time projects. Do your highway construction at that time rather than hiring people and starting ongoing programs that you'd be uncomfortable turning off. And finally, more responsible behavior is the label here. Stop those biennial games where you only feed a few months into the next biennium.
We won't get there either, I
suppose. You asked.
Thank you, Senator Winters.
We budget on a biennial basis. In the private sector, at least I know in my business, we do it annually. In talking about structural changes, would it be more helpful if we were on an annual rather than a biennial basis?
Oh, that's a good question. The biennial budget has the advantage that I sometimes say when my forecast is really, really good that I've been blessed by the god of offsetting errors. You know, you're high on one
really bad.
Yeah. And, you know, in a, the revenue forecast is a quarter-by-quarter number averaged over or summed over eight quarters, and we can be off one quarter and you know, two different quarters offset each other. So that helps us. But the advantage of the annual budget would be a faster reaction time, and we wouldn't be able to wait 18 months into a 24-month period to adjust. If you were to shift to annual budgets, you'd need a greater cushion on a year-by-year basis. I think it's kind of a toss-up. I don't have a strong opinion as to whether the advantages outweigh the disadvantages.
Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My colleague Gordley here just reminded me, and I think it's a point worth bringing out, that our rural economies have been reigning for some 15, 20 years or more. And wouldn't, in a reality check, that be something that we should monitor more closely in this body, that when a major part of the geography of the state, at least, is in economic trouble, eventually that will also have an impact on the whole state?
Senator Messerly, when I look at sort of the rural-urban split, there are some long-term trend issues that do not cause a problem for, say, a revenue forecast or short-run management. And the fact is that the rural parts have been weak and stable. There has not been nearly as much fluctuation in the economic fortunes of the rural sector as there has been in the urban, because they've just been in, as you say, weak condition. So in terms of a structural long-term view, it makes sense to pay attention to the urban-rural differences. But in terms of looking at this business cycle and how much money there is to spend, the fluctuation is really happening at this point in the major urban areas.
Co-Chair Schrader.
Maybe two questions, if I may, Mr. Connerly. One is that we currently have an education stability fund. Are you advocating another rainy day fund in addition to that?
Senator Schrader, I would advocate a rainy day fund if I thought there were a way to actually wait for the rainy day. And I'm nervous about a pot of money that could be tapped on a discretionary basis. But if we could write the rules on a rainy day fund so that we truly wait until it's rainy, then I would advocate putting money aside that way, in addition to the educational reserve fund.
Why would we have two reserve funds?
I don't feel a great desire to have two. But it makes sense to have a general purpose, I think, reserve fund, and not be limited in its use.
Different question. In trying to budget just the previous biennium's revenue, maybe this is a question was asked while I was not here, and I apologize. How does one account for the inevitable inflation that occurs and caseload growth and that sort of thing?
Well, that is a challenge on the spending side, rather than the revenue side, and various agencies have made efforts to forecast caseload per se. And I really don't have much to add to anything helpful to add on that subject.
Editorial comment: business, I'm a tiny business myself. It's a lot easier to control your caseload just by, you know, how you ramp up and who you decide to service. It's not so easy for us in the government sector to determine our own caseload, and that makes it difficult.
Exactly. I agree.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Co-Chair Miller. Following up on Co-Chair Schrader's analysis, on page 4, you talk about the fall 2001, the state headcount continues to grow, reaching an all-time peak. And then when I turn over to page 5 in your options for the revenue system, point 2, 3, and 4 assume that the headcount or the additional headcount is not in need of additional state services. Is that accurate? Has anyone ever done an analysis of what the state's growing headcount looks like and the impact that has on our need to provide services?
Well, when I said headcount, I meant number of state employees.
I apologize. Follow-up question. Has an analysis ever been done to determine what the state as a whole, that growing headcount looks like as the population of Oregon grows? Who's moving into Oregon, and what has been the impact of that growth on Oregon? Are they contributors or financial contributors or financial users of the state system?
Representative Smith, I believe that there is a biannual population survey that studies that. My recollection is that the largest group of people moving into the state are in their 20s and 30s, more often single than the general population because it's easier to move when you're single or without children. And this is a population group that tends to be working and but will soon become users of the school system, you know, after they settle down in a few years. Generally, people who move from state to state are more educated and on average have a higher income than the people who don't move. That's just a broad average, but I would say then that the state benefits from the in-migration more than we're hurt by.
Just follow up then.
Proceed.
Then based upon that, your recommendations truly do hit home, because if, you know, if the folks moving into Oregon are income producers and yet the number of services we continue to provide increases, it seems to be a lack of correlation between the population growth and the program growth.
Yes, it's unclear what actually drives the people in. I have not seen good evidence on whether it is a good state services, whether it is a pleasant environment, availability of lattes on every corner. You know, we talk about quality of life, but we don't have a good firm handle on it. The things that I believe are at the top of the list include housing prices and congestion, but there isn't a lot of good research basis for knowing what draws people here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Bates.
Just a quick question, Mr. Co-Chair. The part I haven't seen discussed here is the part that sets a state government aside from a business. We like to run government as a business as much as possible. I think it's laudable we do that and important that we do that. But during times of recession, things happen that the state is responsible for, the business is not. Caseloads go up across the board for people needing help that have lost their jobs. At the same time, the need for education population goes up also. Historically, people go to higher education during times of recession. They're not working, and they want to prepare themselves for a better job. So at the time that our revenues are going down, the needs of the people of Oregon are actually in many areas doing the opposite and going up. And that brings us back to a question of how much we can run the government as a business and whether we even should. That during times of recession is a time the state government should step up and say, yes, we want to retrain you. We want to get you through this period. We want to do it in economical fashion. And I didn't actually see that as part of the picture here, other than the possibility of changing the revenue to a stable revenue so we can supply those services to people trying to move out. Is that?
Well, Representative Bates, I think you put your finger on the challenge. I don't have a solution to it. The challenge is you would like at least stable revenue, perhaps greater revenue in the downturn, sort of an inverse movement, revenue going up in the downturn, and I don't know of any way, any tax structure that will make that happen.
follow up?
Representative Bates?
I'm not an economist, okay? By the way, I've always wanted economists with one hand, you know, like Truman did, so he can't say on the other hand, all right? From my point of view, it's a combination of things you've been talking about. Stable, which is probably a sales tax or consumer tax of some kind, and a rainy day fund locked in the Constitution that doesn't let the kicker kick until that fund is completed, so it's available for these times. And I think that combination is the only way I see out of this. I don't know if that's what your thoughts are, too. It seems to be that's what you're talking here.
Representative Bates, I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. If the rainy day fund is truly locked in and the revenue stream is more stable, I think you as legislators will feel more comfortable. But let me caution you, you'll feel a little bit less comfortable in the boom years.
Most think we spend too much in the boom.
Let me, I'll recognize Senator Morse, and then what I would suggest is we hear from the remaining panelists, and then we can ask them all these questions if that's okay with the committee. Senator Morse, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Here's this. Excuse me. <don't know> Maybe we need to go off.
Your time's expired.
These issues of fiscal discipline are enough to choke on, but. There was an analysis that came out of the Lundquist School of Business by Philip Romero with respect to changes in personal income and its impact on tax revenue. Are you familiar with that? And if you are, maybe just a comment. But my understanding is that the summary of that analysis was that for every 1% change in personal income, there's an approximate 1.5% change in tax revenue. And I don't know whether I'm recalling that correctly, and if this is something that could predictably be factored in to our revenue projections.
Senator Morse, I haven't actually seen Professor Romero's paper. I am aware that if you average the changes out, I think you would get some kind of relationship such as you describe, where a percentage point of personal income leads to more than a percentage point of revenue, but that is not a very firm, precise, regular relationship. And it gets messed up because the stock market goes up more than personal income goes up, and then your capital gains revenue swings wildly up or down. So I take that relationship as an average, but it is not precise enough to base a revenue forecast on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, welcome back. Thanks for coming.
I'm Jim Johnson, and I am the former Intel site manager. I retired about a year ago, so I'm here as a citizen, not as a representative of Intel. But I am here to give you the high-tech perspective on the economy and as we move forward. By my very nature, I'm an entrepreneur, and therefore I have to be an optimist. But as I come before you today, it's very, very hard for me to be optimistic. We have many, many challenges in front of us. As I look at the global economy, I can be optimistic. Every recession has ended. And even though we feel we're in the middle of this one and it's hurting, it will end. And that's and so those who plan for that and those who respond to that are the ones who ultimately are the successful winners as the recession comes into prosperity. So companies typically, especially in the knowledge economy area, during these recessions, they will cut because they have to cut. Their revenues go down, their expenses go down, so they have to do that. But simultaneously, they invest because they know when the recession ends, that a very important phenomenon happens is that when people start buying again, is that market share shifts happen then, right then. Because if you're a company that didn't invest and your products aren't up to date, when the buyers are ready to buy, they're not going to say, I'll give you six more months to catch up. They're going to buy, and the market share shifts. So businesses look at recessions as huge opportunities that causes them to clean house. I mean, there's no organization, I don't care how well run you are, that can grow and grow and grow and not be efficient. That you will have inefficiencies that will go in. It's just inevitable. You'll try things that will not work, but you want them. You'll keep trying, and then the recession will cause you to kindly say, "Okay, enough is enough." So recession is when people make the hard decisions. That's why we're hearing about layoffs, plant closures, all the things that were before, you know, companies were reluctant to do. In recessions, they do them. But as they do that, they're focusing on their core competencies, what it is they do best, and that's what they're investing in. And so a company that isn't investing is one that has a very bleak future. And so if you look at high-tech companies and you look at stock markets and you look at when they announce that they're going to reduce their R&D, huge reduction in their price stock because people say this company has no future. So that's part of the challenge that we have here in Oregon. The global economy is a reality. We are being affected disproportionately by this global economy, and we don't know why. It's a force that is here. It's a force we cannot ignore. It's a force we have to accept. And in this global economy, knowledge is becoming more and more important. Natural resources are still important, but more and more it is the knowledge around those natural resources that's going to determine winners and losers. We've all gone to restaurants and been offered seafood from around the world. We've all gone to lumber mills right here in this state and saw logs that didn't originate from this state, didn't originate from this country, being processed there. So just being next to a natural resource is no longer good enough to have a successful economy. The other thing that's becoming more and more important in this new global economy is your export dollars. Your economy has to be rooted in those export dollars. You know, order of magnitude, maybe you guys can tell me whether this is right or wrong, but what I've heard from other economists is that a third of an economy tends to be export-oriented, and that third drives the other two-thirds. And we've all seen that, if those from rural Oregon know very well what happens when the mill of a town shuts down, and that's the only export job in the town. The town shuts down. And that's why that one-third, two-third relationship occurs. You've got that one-third that's bringing in that fresh money, and it's being recirculated for whether it's the restaurants or the car repair or all the things we need to live. So we have to have a very sharp focus on those export-oriented jobs, because as they go, we will go. And so a recession is in the midst. And what's been happening? We've been losing these manufacturing jobs, these export-oriented jobs. Now, when the global economy recovers, those jobs will reappear somewhere on this globe. But will they reappear in Oregon? I personally don't think so. Now, it used to be that it was just the manufacturing jobs that were leaving. And many, many companies have just accepted this and deal with it. And what they do is they close down their plants in the U.S. and they move them to someplace else in the world where they can get highly qualified workers at a much lower cost. But in this environment, we're also now seeing knowledge workers beginning to move. I'm, again, not representing Intel, but public information that they've sent out has stated that they are going to grow their technical workforce in their emerging nations. What does that mean? That means China. And, oh, by the way, do you know that China produces more engineers every year than the entire United States? That also means India. Do you know that India produces more engineers than the United States every year? So the fundamentals of us holding this notion that we are the source of all knowledge in the United States and we are the source of all innovation is now being threatened, because the people that generate that knowledge and generate that innovation are now being distributed across the United States. And you have multinational companies that are doing their best to make sure that those engineers are as highly trained and have tools to the best of their ability so they can be as innovative as possible. And Intel is not unique. Mentor Graphics, one of the largest software companies in the state, also has stated it wants to grow most of its software engineers now in India. So as other nations are developing and providing these knowledge workers, we are being threatened. So we're being threatened by our manufacturing base, and we're being threatened by our intellectual base. So what is Oregon doing to focus on creating these export-oriented, knowledge-oriented jobs? What is our strategy? I think that's a very important question that has to have an answer. And Jim Johnson doesn't see an answer. When I walk into an elevator, I see a fellow business person, I'll ask him a question, and I expect an answer by the time we get to the fourth or fifth floor. You know, every company has their mission statement. Every company has their strategy that they can express. Where are they going? I don't think Oregon can answer that question when it comes to our economy. The old rules just simply don't apply. We are expecting that when the national economy recovers, we will recover. You know, and when the tide goes up, every boat's going to float. But I believe we are going to be very long in this recession, and we are going to lag that recovery. Is Boeing going to replace its jobs? Is Freightliner going to replace its jobs? Are the plants that are, these high-tech plants that have closed down, are they going to replace those jobs? I don't know. We can ask other people's opinions. I'm not very optimistic. Because you look at the fundamentals of what is Oregon doing to invest in these knowledge workers? What is Oregon doing to invest in these export-oriented jobs that will drive our economy? And the most fundamental of those investments is education. Whether it's K-12 or higher ed, it's education. And I don't need to quote any of the numbers to you about where we rank in our investments in K-12 and higher ed. We have a very, very long-term problem that has to be addressed, and we have to make some progress there. And you have very, very difficult challenges ahead of you trying to prioritize where to take the limited resources that we have and where to invest those. But I can tell you, and I would encourage you, to make sure that we start creating these jobs as quickly as we can, which means we need to be investing in our higher education system at a disproportionately increasing rate, because they are the ones that are going to produce these new high-paying jobs. Again, you know, it's if we look at our amount of money we contribute to each student, you know, we look at our ranking, you know, and it's quite, as you know, quite poor. California, University of California, Davis, which when I went to school, I know that was a few decades ago, was considered a cow town, is a leading institution with a top engineering school. The state contributes $14,000 a student. Pretty phenomenal investment. Now, just investing in higher ed doesn't solve the problem. California has its challenges, too. But its economy is much more diverse, much more complex. And one way of getting stability is having diversity. And we in Oregon have to look at how can we have a diverse knowledge-based economy. To complement the existing economy we have, we need to keep going with natural resources. I'm not trying to say that anything we have, we shouldn't be, you know, we want a diverse economy. But where is the world economy going? And are we ignoring that? Or are we trying to take advantage of that? And again, we have not been very good at trying to do this. So mine is, I'll call it a strategic analysis of this. I'm not an economist. I'm just a simple business person, and I'm trying to understand why is it that Oregon's economy should grow? What is the strategies? What are we doing to cause our economy to grow? Maybe as a way of analogy, and I apologize if I offend someone, but I have four daughters. Four daughters, believe me. The youngest is now 19. One of my daughters is strikingly beautiful. She happens to also be the laziest one of the group. Life is handed to her on a silver platter. She basically doesn't have to work for anything. She raises her hand, and she's got guys around her making sure that her life is quite comfortable. But now, all of a sudden, she's realizing that there are other women around her that are just as beautiful. And she doesn't know how to go after and earn what she wants. She doesn't have the skill set because the necessity has never been there. I'll claim that Oregon's economy has never had the necessity to say, this is where we want to go. We need to plan for it. We need to commit to it. And we need to go after it. You know, it's just come because Oregon has tremendous natural resources, tremendous beauty, and has a wonderful form of government that's done many, many wonderful things. But, you know, there are a lot of other places that have that too now. And we have to decide what we want, and we're going to have to go after it. And I think that is one of our biggest challenges. So I look at little indicators. Now, again, I'll be very, you know, straightforward. I believe it's knowledge economy. I believe it's commitment in higher education. I believe it's commitment to research. It's commitment to that research that will create new ideas that are unique to Oregon that can be then commercialized here, that we have to grow our own. Yes, we certainly want other companies to move here. I'd like people to grow their divisions here and do that. But we have to establish industries that are born here and grow here, and that will be a protection or a way of us having an economy that we are in control of. And so investing in a higher education system, investing in research, is one way of doing that. Now, I know that the OCED, the Oregon Council of Economic Knowledge and Development, has a proposal. And it's I would consider an extremely modest proposal. It's $80 million being matched by $60 million in private. And I know $80 million is a lot of money, but in a $10 billion budget, $80 million is not a lot of money. But it's an indication of commitment of, is this important to us or not? And so if we're saying we can't even deal with $80 million, and I know that whole process is still in play and we haven't made a decision one way or the other, but if we say we can't afford it because of all the difficult economic conditions we're in, and I know we're having to make very, very difficult decisions, and we're having to refuse services to people that really need it, but you have to ask yourself, where is our future revenue going to come from? Where are we investing? As our four daughters were growing up, we made sacrifices because we said we want them to go to college. We're going to save the money now. Now, I know that an individual is different than business, but there shows an intent of what you're trying to do. You're saying this is important, so we prioritize this over that. And sometimes it hurt. But that's what's really got to happen here. So Oregon, by its actions, will determine or state what its priorities are. And I think that's what we've got to decide. So in a knowledge economy, in a globalized knowledge economy, investing in your workforce, investing in your people, investing in excellence, investing in innovation is what has to happen. And Oregon has to develop a plan to focus on that. So my solution doesn't solve your economic problems today. You could make all these investments and you're not going to see revenue streams for 5 to 10 years. But again, 30 years ago, someone said we really want the high-tech industry here. And in the last 10 years, we all benefited greatly because it became the largest economic sector in the state. So making those long-term investments can pay off. And this is a very difficult time to make an investment, but it is the time that we have to stand up and say, where do we want Oregon? Will my grandchildren have an opportunity to have a high-wage job in Oregon, or will they be required to leave the state and go to, you know, I can, I'm sure you've read, there's, you know, I can, you know, there were state addresses from all the different governors. You know, Nevada's talking about their investment, $47 million. You've got New Mexico talking about creating a $10 million fund plus a $200 million investment fund. You got Idaho talking about their investments. Ohio, I mean, it goes on and on. Governors are saying, we want the knowledge economy in our states, and we're willing to make investments. We're all going to do it differently, and, you know, competitive, you know, nature will find out which of the approaches is best. But right now, Oregon isn't even in the game. But we have an inherent advantage. We are ninth, if you look at the number of high-tech workers per 1,000 private workers, ninth in the nation. We have an asset. We have a set of assets that there are 40 other states that wish they had, that we have. But we're not really leveraging that. So I think the capability and the reason, there is reason for optimism, but we as a state have to state, this is our strategy and this is where we're going. And traditional economic development processes have to evolve to acknowledge the knowledge economy. So I would encourage all of us to engage in this debate and to move forward and hopefully decide that Oregon's economy will be successful in the 21st century, will be part of the knowledge economy, and will do what it takes to make that happen.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm sure you've generated some questions and comments, which will come later. So, again, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Mr. Ruffalo.
Representative Miller, we were given a set of questions, and so I wrote my answers to that and have some copies here, and I was just going to briefly summarize my responses and allow you to read them at leisure and allow for more opportunity for questions. That would be okay?
That'd be fine. Thank you.
The first question that we were asked is, when do we see Oregon recovering from the current recession? How strong will the recovery be? And how will it affect state revenues? Basically, my response is the recovery from the recession has already started, but I do see a very slow recovery. There are lots of possibilities for a very rapid recovery at the national or international level that would then have repercussions for Oregon. On the other hand, I think if we look around the nation and the world, we really see a lot more possibilities for negative outcomes and for additional drag on the recovery. In particular, if we start looking at the nation, I don't really see any strong areas or any possibility of rapid increases in growth. I think what we see at the national level is the same thing we've seen at the state level, which is that the recovery keeps being pushed off by the forecasters. And I don't see a lot of reason for optimism. And then when we look internationally, I think we see that there are many countries that are having similar economic problems and some having very severe disruptions. So if we look at the issues in terms of are there going to be changes in the nation or the world that are going to just pull us up, I think the answer to that is I would be very skeptical that that's the most likely outcome in the near future. And hence, I think, you know, there will be a recovery, but it's going to continue on a relatively slow level. The other question is, what is Oregon's relative role in the recovery? And I look back to the early 1990s, and I see that there are lots of things that look very attractive in Oregon. We had relatively low housing prices. Measure 5, while there may have been negative repercussions, they promised lower property taxes. We saw that services were generally good, substantial land for available for construction. A lot of things that laid the groundwork for economic growth. And if we look out there now, we don't see similar positives. In fact, many of these have now become impediments. Housing prices are now relatively high. There are a variety of other things that have shifted Oregon from being a relatively attractive place for economic growth to being a less attractive place for economic growth. So I think as the nation and the world recover, we're not going to see our growth at the relative rate compared to them that we have in the past. So for those reasons, I'm relatively skeptical about a strong recovery in the near future. I think the recovery is going. It will continue, but not at an optimistic pace. Certainly there's lots of uncertainty about the forecast, and I can easily see conditions where we would see a very rapid recovery and so on. If the war in Iraq is over quickly and terrorism moves away from concerns, but I don't honestly believe that that's what we're going to see in the very near future. In terms of tax revenue, Bill has already mentioned a lot of the problems. Basically, when you rely on the income tax, over time, it's a very, very positive tax source because tax revenue tends to grow up faster than than personal income. Question that was raised earlier about what happens at the margin. If you look at the Oregon tax rate, it's about, top rate of 9%, but the average tax collection is only about 4.2% of personal income. We have lots of exemptions. We have areas of zero bracket and so on. Whereas all of the marginal income gets taxed at the highest rate, for most people. And so what we see is that when, you know, if you're unemployed for a month, your income goes down by a certain percentage, but your tax burden goes down by a larger percentage. Similarly, if the economy is booming and you're working overtime, your income goes up by a certain percentage, but your state tax payments go up by a bigger percentage. And so the cyclical sensitivity of the income tax is important, and it's already been discussed. And even more important, during the 90s, we had some very large windfalls associated with capital gains. I definitely stay away from predicting stock market changes, but I think anyone would tell you we're not going to see that again. That the level of capital gains that we saw during, you know, during the late 90s just will not happen, and that really was a windfall for our tax system. So when we look at what the implications of economic growth are going to be for state revenue, I'm again relatively on the pessimistic side. I think we're going to see growth, but we're not going to see state revenue growing proportionately as rapidly as we have in the past. The second question deals with the business cycle. Has the nature of the cycle changed? What are the implications for Oregon? Are recessions longer and deeper? And is deflation a legitimate concern? My first comment is that historically business cycles have been getting basically shorter and milder over time. However, this particular cycle clearly has some characteristics that are different from the standard cycle. Concerns about war and terrorism are certainly a drag on the economy. There are many other issues, not the least of which has been the loss in wealth associated with the decline in the stock market. I think, again, if you look at it from a longer-term perspective, the wealth that individuals have largely affects their spending patterns. And the decline in wealth associated with the decline in the stock market has had an impact on spending patterns, but it's going to be a long-term impact. It's not just a one-time, oh, gee, you know, I've lost half my pension fund, I'll cut back my spending this year. It cuts back your spending over a longer period of time, and it's going to impact on the rate of recovery. The question of deflation I thought was an interesting one. It certainly can't be ruled out. Again, if consumers are holding back in savings, businesses are not investing, it's certainly possible that prices will decline. But personally, I'm actually more concerned about the possibility of a resurgence of inflation and what was called a stagflation scenario during the 70s when we had a weak economy along with inflation. I did work for the Fed for a while, and one of the things that I learned there is that monetary policy always works with a long and variable lag. And it doesn't always work the way we want it to. While the stimulus that the Fed has been putting into the economy ideally will show up in higher output and higher employment, there are other characteristics such as the rise in energy prices that may simply turn it into higher prices. And so I am concerned that we may see rising inflation without as much of an impact on the recovery. In terms of Oregon's long-term prospects, is Oregon still attractive? Are there state policies that would improve Oregon's long-term prospects? My general response to questions like this is that government really doesn't determine what happens in the private sector. That, in particular, I think Oregon puts far too much emphasis on trying to attract particular industries. Mr. Johnson pointed out that that at some point high-tech grew. Well, I was on the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors during the early 80s, and when I was saying things like, well, you know, there's going to be growth, the conditions are right, I was told that, well, high-tech can't grow because Tektronix was the major contributor at the time, and they were declining. We did grow in the high-tech area. It was not because of government intervention at the time. It was because this was a good place for certain types of industries to grow and prosper, and that worked its way through the economy. To the extent that we, you know, that the investments in attracting high tech specifically have been successful, I would argue they've made the current business cycle worse. What they've done is they've forced a concentration of economic activity into a highly cyclically sensitive sector, whereas diversification of the employment base might have been a little bit better in terms of the impact it would have had on the state over the business cycle. I personally believe that it's the general conditions that make for long-term economic growth, not the ability to attract specific industries. On the other hand, I would definitely agree with Mr. Johnson that, you know, what the state does is important. My perspective is that, you know, I like to think about the state as in effect a business. If you provide good services for low tax prices, then you're an attractive place and people and businesses locate here. If, on the other hand, you have high taxes and poor services, you're likely to deter investment and deter people from living here. And so what I would focus on in terms of long-term economic growth is for the state to do what the state is supposed to do, which is focus on the services that people value, try to keep costs down, try to keep taxes down, and try to provide a good environment for growth and for profitability of businesses. Again, to keep it short, I want to leave some time for questions. I think the focus should be on providing effective services in a cost-effective manner and trying to avoid some of the things that have clearly gone wrong in the past. I think the suggestions that you've heard already for either a bigger ending balance or a rainy day fund to smooth out the fluctuations in state spending are very important. I was here 2 years ago making a recommendation, basically discussing Representative Shetterly's business activities tax. And one of the things that I pointed out was that stability in state spending is important. It's not just the question of the level, but that these rapid fluctuations and loss of services really do have a very negative impact. We're seeing some of it through the national press, but I think even more directly, when you have major cuts in services, it does disrupt people's lives. It does disrupt their perception about the desirability of being here. And so stability and efficiency are the things that I think state government should be focusing on, and that if anything, you should put less effort into trying to pick the winners and losers. Try to make the place a good profitable place for businesses, an attractive place for individuals, and the economy will take care of itself. You can't really figure out what the appropriate industries are, and I know of no government that has been successful in the long run in identifying which businesses are going to grow and making that happen.
Thank you for your presentation. Mr. Nguyen?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, sorry I spoke too soon. I do have the answer, except that I don't have them down in writing. But what I would do, I hope it would be acceptable to all of you, instead of addressing these answers, since most of my colleagues and fellow panelists answer the question posed, I would just rather focus on a certain risk issue. Never before that I felt that we're in such a risk for a long extended or for that matter a double dip recession. Part of it, as some of my panelists have pointed out and some of you have raised, has to do with the rising energy cost. Let's give you some numbers, some idea, and you can see the magnitude of what we're facing. The U.S., and as far as Oregon is concerned, we can take 1% of that, and that should be a good rule of thumb. We spend roughly about $600 billion on energy as of last year, the latest data available, and that including oil, natural gas, and electricity. Now, prices has roughly doubled, almost. Oil last year below 20, now roughly $37. Natural gas last year about $3. It's about $7, depending on the future you're looking at a spot market. And recently as high as $10 per million BTU. Electricity has risen as well, although has not been passed on directly to customers. But it will be passed on down the road. There's no question that would be the case. So you're looking roughly a doubling of the bill, everything else equal. That is, as it now stands, without further increases or without a decline in prices, of roughly $600 million. You can think of it in terms of a tax. That's a lot of money. I mean, you're talking about 6% of the GDP. Or for that matter, it's a rule of thumb, 6% of your income. I mean, these it's a tax that don't really go to the treasury of the U.S. or the state. 60% of that is go to exporter, And the largest exporter at this point is Saudi Arabia. And let me move on. In addition to the higher prices, obviously, producer and industrial and commercial user will have to pass it on to consumer. And that will, in turn, raise prices down the road. I mean, think about it. Airline, UPS, Albertsons, these folks will face higher costs. There's no question about that. And given that they already make little profit, losing money, the possibility for them to not to pass this on to consumers is very remote. I can see that scenario that Tony mentioned earlier. Now, in the oil market, expert estimated roughly about 2 million barrels per day of excess capacity. Again, you can debate whether it's high or low or accurate or inaccurate. But this is roughly about the same as it was during the Gulf War, the previous Gulf War. Now, the capacity, remember, is even lower on a relative basis. Back during the 90s, during the Gulf War period, the world consumed roughly about 60 million barrels a day. I'm sorry, 66 million barrels a day. Currently, the world's consumed about 76 million barrels a day, an increase of 10 million barrels a day. We use a lot of oil. The world uses a lot of oil. Now, 60% of that capacity, I mean, the demand has to be met by somebody and by someone, and that 60% of that came from OPEC, and roughly about 50% of all of that came from Saudi Arabia. It is producing as much as it can right now, roughly about 8.5 to 9 million barrels a day, and it thinks that it can add it on another million barrels a day. The rest came from Asia, and that would be the little countries such as Malaysia, Vietnam, Thailand, Australia, and nobody realized that, but it's also from the North Sea, Norway. Contrary to the media and press releases, the Eastern, or the formerly Soviet Union, in Eastern bloc has not added anything to the production at all. They have increased export some, but that because of less consumption domestically. Now, natural gas, I mean, you all heard about it. I look at some data, and it's really alarming because you can't really turn that around either. The weather has a lot to do with that, but so is fundamentals such as reserve production ratio. That is, you drill a lot, you use a lot, you produce, but not a whole lot of reserve being found. I'll give you an idea the situation, the current situation. The average of storage for the whole U.S. is roughly about 1.5 BCF, billion cubic feet. Now, currently, I'm just looking at the graph yesterday, the number has dropped to below 800 BCF. Now, it means that there are only roughly 14 days available that we can extract the stuff from BCF. We use roughly, the whole nation uses roughly about 55 BCF. And so very limited. And even there's no more cold weather down the road, and by that I mean by spring and summer, the producer will have to refill storage. It means that going to next fall and winter, they'll be not be able to refill all the storage for the next heating season. It means that prices will stay high no matter what. These are really a big concern. How does that affect the recession scenario? No question in my mind it poses the largest risk in addition to the geopolitical risk. I don't want to spend a lot of time on the geopolitical risk, but the cost is right there, and it will have to be financed by taxpayer ultimately. And we're looking at larger growing deficit. No question that will be the case. And there's, again, as Milton Friedman often said, there's no free lunch. Somebody will have to pay for it. Now, just sort of closing on the business cycle, I have with me some data and something I want to share with you. Tony was right that the average cycle has been sort of shortened, at least in the recession period in the post-war. The average between since 1945 to 1991, about seven cycles, roughly 11 months now, 43 months up. Now, we're now roughly about 2 years, 24 months, we're in this recession. So everything else equal, chances for us to come out of it will be good, be better than even absent geopolitical and energy risk. Now, let me move back to the Oregon situation. For many of us, including many of you in our professional adult life, you can recall what happened in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. In the 70s, if I recall, during the depth of recession, imagine a scenario where the state and for that matter, the U.S. climbing out of it was difficult, to put it mildly. You oftentimes, in your mind, you always try to do a bottom-up approach. That is, if we are coming out of this, who would be the first, and so on and so forth. And in the early 80s recession, we all know that lumber and wood took a beating. But, you know, to everybody's surprise, that the recovery was led by housing and auto. And housing, for us, would mean lumber and wood. And, in fact, we did. We rebounded in that sector alone. We added 10,000 jobs from the depth of the recession, the 80s, to about 4 or 5 years later. High-tech was much later. High-tech didn't really play a significant role in during that period of recovery in Oregon. Now, in the 90s recession, now this time it was not housing and auto or lumber and wood, but it was high-tech. High-tech took place, or growth took place in mid and late 90s, part of that because of what you folks have done, removal of repealing of unitary tax and later on the SIP program, and high-tech took off for credit. Now, it's very hard for me, looking forward, to try to do another bottom-up exercise. Who would be in which sector, which industry, which company will lead the recession? I mean, lead out of the recession? The answer is a little bit of everything. I think it's often been cited, repetitious, but again, rising tide lifts all boats. Take a look at Freightliner. That is one company, it's very industry and has to do with regulation specific issue, but if the demand is there, everybody buying into our products, you see it turn around. Let me move on to the sort of answer the question of income elasticity. I haven't seen the study that you referred to, Senator Morris, but I've seen a summary of that, and a summary of the studies, I should say, as well as a study of sales tax elasticity as well. The rule of thumb is that income elasticity is greater than one. And again, we don't know what it is and where it is. And the reason for that, the rationale for that, has to do with the bracket creep and cap on exemption and deduction and so on and so forth. Because let's say if you have a fixed tax rate, a flat tax rate, then you never have any elasticity greater than one. On the sale tax, oftentimes it's been cited, and most studies tend to confirm that it's less than one, and part of it because the majority and the preponderance of essential good that the people still have to buy. As a result, that intuitively you could expect elasticity, sale tax elasticity, to be less than one. I can go on, but I think I'm open for questions.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I would say that if any member of the committee was going to go off and have a restful, calm weekend, you've destroyed all chance of that. But it's very helpful information, as we obviously have to plan the budget for the next 2 years. Mr. Ruffalo, if I understood your comment to be right, that the economy is going to go up and down in spite of our efforts to get in the way or be helpful. Is that a fair representation? I'm struck between Mr. Johnson's comments about us being very proactive in trying to create a situation where we are attractive to industry, the kind that you would suggest. We don't have a clue what it would be, so how do you get that specific, I guess?
Representative Miller. Yeah, it's in the economics jargon, it's the differentiation between looking at exports as the driver of growth and looking at your supply side, your resources, your infrastructure, your labor force. And one of the examples that I use in my class is, if you really believe the export-based model, which is that the only way you grow is by exporting, then the world should not be growing because we do not sell to any other planet. ultimately, it is the productive capacity that determines what you're actually going to be able to produce. I do agree with Mr. Johnson that that you do need to focus on the things that make the economy productive, on education, on infrastructure, on services that are valued. On the other hand, as I said, I actually did a review for the Department of Economic Development about 10 years ago of the effectiveness of state incentives for economic development, and it's amazing how much of a consensus there is in the scholarly literature that it's not very effective, that most of the things that states do may change the mix of development. They may attract, you know, high tech in places that other firms would have grown if they hadn't attracted high tech. They may move activity around within the state or within a locality by giving incentives, but they have very little effect on overall rates of growth or employment. So that these targeted attempts to attract specific industries are just not very successful. On the other hand, there is evidence that over the longer term, things like tax policy and services do matter. Again, you know, if you look at very simple examples, high taxes don't necessarily deter growth. What you do find is that high taxes and low services do deter growth. What you really need to do is look at what balance you can achieve between providing the services that people and businesses desire and keeping taxes low relative to the package of services that you're providing. Everything else being equal, if you raise taxes, it's negative. Everything else being equal, if you lower services, it's negative. But there are clearly opportunities for efficiency in government that that do allow for growth, and there are also clearly opportunities for effective investment in education and infrastructure that also promote growth.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
A couple of comments. One is we can take the strategic investment program as an example. I can tell you that there would be an Intel plant somewhere in this world, independent of whether that program passed or not. I can guarantee you if it didn't pass here, it wouldn't be here. Now, has it been beneficial to Oregon's economy that there's someone building a $2.5 billion plant in Hillsboro, actually building two of them? Is that beneficial to us? Was that an act of government that affected that? So it depends on what global view you want to take. Yeah, a plant's going to get built, but do we want it to happen here? I can tell you that land use has a huge impact. If we choose not to have any large lots available on the west side of Portland, there'll be no large businesses coming to the west side of Portland. Now, is that an act of government? Do you have effect that? I think you do. The permitting process. If we want to make it an undefinable process that can take anywhere from 1 week to 3 years, will that have an effect on where businesses locate here or not? It certainly will. So I think there is agreement is that I don't think a government can say we want this specific kind of industry. They can say, you know, this specific company. You do have to focus on creating the right environment. You know, Oregon has great soil, and it rains, and we grow certain things here. But we also don't grow other things here that don't like our environment. So we've got to decide what kind of environment we want to create, and therefore what kind of jobs we want to encourage to be here. Having a strong education base means we'll have knowledge-based industry. If we don't have a strong education base, we won't have those kinds of industries here. So I think government plays an important role in the foundation of what kind of environment or what kind of economy we have.
Well, obviously these things conflict, as I think you pointed out, with respect to land available for development. Also would note that whereas there are many who tout the benefits of the land use planning system, it has, in the eyes of many, resulted in the highest cost of land for housing, certainly in the western half of the United States, and that may have some impact on who can come here, housing affordability. Certainly during the period of the 80s and 90s, when maybe we were comfortable, at least in some of those years, it may have been fashionable to pretty much say you couldn't go into the forest except to backpack. And now we pay that penalty as we became dependent on high tech, which is now suffering. And I don't know whether these times, in your review, have caused governments to take a second look at policies they used to do because it was nice policy, didn't seem to have a negative economic effect, but now it's time to get real. Is that
Representative Miller? I think, first of all, I think Mr. Johnson and I don't really disagree except possibly on the strategic investment program. I think it is certainly clear that higher housing prices are a deterrent to people moving here, that the lack of land is a deterrent for businesses locating here, and that we, you know, in that sense, those are government policies that really do need to be reviewed if you want to look at the climate for long-term economic growth. You know, there may be benefits to growth boundaries. When I first came here in the early 1980s, my view on the growth boundary was it's a good idea if it's going to be managed. It's a bad idea if it's going to become a noose. And it's becoming a noose. What we've done is we've moved from growth management, which as I understood it was the original intent, to growth limitation. And growth limitation does, you know, it may be great during boom times, but growth limitation doesn't look so good during the recession.
Senator Harper?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, like Senator Miller, am kind of sorry we invited you guys here today. Well, let me see if I could pin you guys down, if I could, for a specific budgeteer's question. Prudent ending balance, biennial ending balance, if I could just get your thoughts. I don't want to frame anything for you, but we have from the state economists 4-7%. We heard from Mr. Connerly, 5%. Jim, do you have a feel for what you would recommend?
I don't have an explicit feel. I think the issue that I'd have to get understand is I have to understand the volatility of my revenue streams. And that, to me, is what's going to drive my ending balance. Because I think, again, you've got to figure out that in the worst-case scenario, you can still get through this thing. And I think that lack of analysis of our revenue streams and the volatility, I mean, the notion of bracketing, I think, is really important. I mean, the state economists, I actually feel quite sorry for them. They've got to come up with a number. And I think that's just a ridiculous system. There's no way that that number can be right. The only question you can have is how wrong will it be, right? I mean, and so you really need a system that says, okay, here's my best guess at a number, but then here's my range that I would feel comfortable with. And you, as managers, would be able to judge, you know, how big of a range that is, determine what comfortable level you would say you'd be willing to spend. So you're not given really the information you need to manage the budget.
So you're not going to give me a number?
Yeah.
Want to make sure, Mr. Ruffalo?
Representative Miller, Senator Harper, I'll give you a number. If you look at other states, the typical guideline is 5 to 10% of the budget for either a rainy day fund or an ending balance. Given the volatility that we have inherent in our heavy reliance on the income tax, I would opt for the higher range, and I would look at the general fund budget, not at all funds. Many of the other funds have their own contingencies and in some ways have more stable revenue sources.
Thank you. Mr. Nguyen.
I don't really have anything to add except that you believe in the conservative financial planner, then you want to put away, what, 1 year worth of salary? That may be too much, but I think...
No, I'm asking the question. Okay.
No, and that's a serious answer as well, too. It is as conservative as you want it to be.
Yeah, okay. That may be tough to do this biennium. Okay. Thank you. Thank everybody except Mr. Thompson.
Representative Patridge, your question?
Yeah. Part of the struggle that we have, too, is, you know, is what's the number going to be? And I know you've all said that it's hard to hit the number.
Yes,
but
we
have to hit a number based upon a budget, just like a corporation. And I have to hit some sales projections and sales figures. And we don't come in quarterly to rebalance or do any of those types of things. And we've kind of asked you to look at the, you know, the economic forecast for the future and what we're facing now as we address budgeting for these various agencies. And we can set the bar based upon some of the recommendations you've given us and other things in terms of what we want to put in reserve. My question to you is more, where do you think that, you know, I'll ask you the question we asked Tom Petowski. Are we on track with what you see as the economy going forward with the projections we have? You know, they've given us a degree of certainty, plus or minus, what, $100 million, I think, was for the May forecast. But that's what we're really faced with. And and you all put a different, you know, face and spin and educational background or bias or whatever you want to say to all these. I'm wondering from at least the three economists, are we within the range that we should be budgeting at, or should we be budgeting for something that's lower based upon what you know and feel about our economy, and if so, how much?
I'll take that. Representative Patridge, I looked at the economic side of that, and I think it's a middle-of-the-road forecast. And in the discussions of the Council of Economic Advisors, the Council recommends to Tom Petowski that he look to be in the middle, have equal probability of overestimating as underestimating. So he's not trying to give you a minimal guaranteed number. He's trying to give you the center.
And I understand that.
You need to keep that in mind. My own forecast, conditioned upon a satisfactory and rapid conclusion of the Iraq uncertainty, if that happens, then I am more optimistic than the state economic forecast, and especially for 2004, not so much for 2003. I am growing, as I said, increasingly nervous about the near-term response to the Iraq issue. So sort of my best guess is higher than the state number, but my worst possibility is perhaps lower than what you see.
Okay.
Yeah, Tony.
Representative Miller, Representative Patridge. I think basically I would agree with what Bill has just said. If you look at the process by which the state forecast is made, Tom Petowski gets lots of input from both the internal economists and from the Governor's Council and so on, and is trying to balance out the pessimists and the optimists. What I would caution you to look at is basically the extremely large range of uncertainty that the current forecast carries with it. There are many more unknowns and many more uncertainties in this forecast than we would typically have looking 2 years ahead. And I think because of that, you have to be much more cautious.
Mr. Chair, represent Petrich. I also serve on the Governor's Council Economic Advisor, colleague of Bill, and we tried to provide the State of Congress with our best guess or our best opinion on the economic issues. You asked a question that I don't really have an answer because there's so much uncertainty at this point. The least of it has to do with the geopolitical or the Iraq war scenario, or how's that pan out, and again, energy issues. I think in the near term, I'm more pessimistic now than I was a few months ago because of what the energy market has reacted to it, and I don't see a quick turnaround on that equation. So I think it's prudent to be on the conservative side in the near term. I don't see any problem, and I think I would reiterate Bill's comment that it is a good middle-of-the-road forecast. You know, back to what you do with it is always the $64 million question. You can't do anything about the weather, but you can hedge. I think part of that is you hedge and you bet it on the downside. And you know, in the business world, you can hedge by increased cash account. You can involve in derivatives and whatnot. And in your case, that would be a rainy day fund and be conservative on the spending side. I wish that I could be more optimistic. A few years ago, known as the bull on the council, that it's always, and I've been right because the economy has it has been came in stronger than we expected. This is the first time I feel much more pessimistic than most of my colleagues on the council. Thank you.
And a non-economist view is you've had, is it seven or eight down?
Seven.
So what makes you believe that you've hit the bottom? So until I see the bottom, which means I see a forecast that goes up, I'd be at the low end saying it's going to get lower. And, you know, I mean, forecasting is very hard, but actuals are actuals. And I'd be looking at my actuals to kind of try to determine this trend.
Unfortunately, we can't budget on actuals. We have to budget on.
No, but we can learn from the past forecasts, which I think is the point. Representative or Senator Morris was next.
I suspect this question would please my predecessor from Albany, who served on this panel. The comments that you made about economic development and how to achieve that begs the question, do we need an economic development department, number one? And if the answer to that is yes, then what should that department look like and what should it focus on as we craft this budget into the future? Open to the panel. Question.
Sure. Representative Miller, Senator Morse, I'll give it a shot. Basically, as I indicated, I think the evidence is that economic development programs run by states don't have any long-term net effect. So in that sense, I would say there's no role for economic development. On the other hand, I think it is also quite clear that there are concerns about urban versus rural. There is evidence that you can move activity around within the state, and that if there is a political consensus that there should be some aid given to rural areas, I think that would be a role for economic development. If there is a consensus that we need to do a little bit more marketing of the state, I'm not sure that it's really effective, but I don't think the evidence on whether it's effective or not is as clear as the evidence on targeting individual firms. So that might be a possibility. I think the thing that you really want to cut back on are targeted incentives for specific firms. I think the evidence is reasonably clear that the net effect of that is fairly small.
Representative Butler?
Thank you very much. I've appreciated the discussion, and I just had one question, and I think this is probably directed to Dr. Ruffalo. any evidence that that we have a increase or an enhancement in productive capacity by an increased minimum wage?
Representative Butler, I would say that it's exactly the opposite. That a minimum wage, in a booming economy and a strong urban area doesn't really have much of an effect. But I think even looking historically at the pattern between urban and rural areas, I think you can make a strong case that the minimum wage in Oregon has had a negative effect on the rural areas, where it has been a binding constraint, as opposed to the urban areas where the wages probably would have been at or above that in any case. And I think certainly during the recession, it's more likely to have a negative impact. I mean, it's one of the things that I currently perceive of as being a drag on the recovery for Oregon, that, you know, we've raised it, and it may not be a big impact, but it's one of the things that contributes to the slow employment growth.
Thank you very much.
Senator George, did you seek recognition?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This will be the panel. And yesterday, at a debate with a colleague in the building, we were talking about a portfolio of brand new taxes on business and eliminating some of the tax incentive programs that are built into to our budget. And I began to think, as this individual was talking about the different things that we're seeing, particularly the Portland area, and that's brand new taxes, you know, the portfolio of business taxes, are from system development charges, you know, to tax on business activity and those sort of things. And it begins to me to provide a kind of an image that we will project outside of this state, that in fact we intend to tax significantly business and relative to what our friend from Portland General Electric said, was that we already have a $600 million tax in just the energy costs that business is facing. What kind of a message do you think that we will send, and do you think that will have a negative impact if we, for example, take the taxes on business up to the level of the individual and that we eliminate a lot of the investment incentives that we've built in?
Senator George, I have a very small consulting firm. From my office window, I can look out at Multnomah County and the city of Portland, but I'm not in Multnomah County or the city of Portland, because I did not want to pay the business income tax, and I have the option to avoid it by my choice of office location. Other businesses do the same thing. So we can move things around, and where you raise taxes, you move activity. I have a friend who had a he was an attorney primarily serving clients out of state. He was a very specialized person dealing with corporations from the West Coast to the East Coast. He could locate anywhere, and he recently moved to Nevada. And I said, gee, Ben, is there anything that could convince you to stay in Oregon? And he says, well, Bill, I think I'm going to save $30,000 a year moving to Nevada. If you want to write me the check, I'll stay. I wished him well and said goodbye. So, you know, we are in competition with other states. And what we see is the people want services, no doubt about that. The people also want low taxes. And the areas that will succeed will be not necessarily the low-tax states or the high-service states, but those that provide the best bang for the buck.
Representative Miller, Senator George. I think I agree with most of what Bill said. One comment, you mentioned systems development charges. One of the things that I look at in a tax system is whether there is a balance between the charges and the services. And I personally find that we use systems development charges much too little in this state, that in effect, new development creates a it creates a demand for infrastructure, and I think to the extent that we balance the revenue sources to pay for that infrastructure with the demand for it, that we actually improve the overall structure. Other than that, again, as Bill said, I think it's the balance. You know, taxes aren't necessarily bad. It's the balance between the taxes and the services and how that then affects the overall attractiveness of the location.
Mr. Chairman, could I clarify my question?
Senator George?
The whole idea is the portfolio. In other words, we are where we are now, and it's not good. But then we're talking about adding on to the burden. That's the question, is will the addition of the burden send a message to anyone who might think about investing or continuing investment here?
I guess that's addressed to me. Clearly higher taxes do have a deterrent effect. I guess, especially in the short run, I think that the impact of it is mitigated. But I would be more concerned with the long run effect of the balance between taxes and services than specifically what happens in the short run. But definitely, an increase does make it less attractive. As Bill said, people who have an option are going to move, but they're not going to move tomorrow. It's really more of a long term effect.
On taxes and business, taxes is a very much a function of the kind of business you're in and the tax structure. I'll tell you, if you're going to invest $2.5 billion in a plant and you're going to charge property tax on every dollar you put in that plant, that will affect the decision. It's black and white. There's no question about it. So the tax structure has an effect. And whether you're a small business or a large business, you're going to look at these things differently. I happen to believe that it's more of the fundamentals that drive about location. So the Intel example is an extreme. I mean, there's not many people that put $2.5 billion into a plant. But if you look at kind of create new jobs, California has a very high tax structure. It creates lots of new jobs. And there are other things that cause companies to go certain places. And so you have to look at the whole balance of that. Mm-hmm. I think from our perspective is that we have to be cautious about, the Doonesbury stuff about us in the national press is something that is going to have a very profound effect on us. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take us a long time to change anyone's attitudes about Oregon and education. Mm-hmm. So we have become, not because we did it, but, Doonesbury did it. We're now the Appalachia of the West Coast. And I think we've got a huge, huge issue there. And if there's a time and to be making an investment in our education system and changing that image in a knowledge economy, now is the time. So do I want to pay more taxes? No. But do I also want to live in a state that has the perception of the worst education system in the United States? No. Will I pay more money to correct that? Yes. So, I mean, we've got a bunch of difficult choices in front of us. And I think we have to... It's never so simple as just, do I like this tax or not? We've got a huge problem. We have a huge strategic problem with our image, and we better correct that. And the sooner we correct it, the better, because the longer it hangs around, the longer it's going to take for us to correct that. So what is the economic impact of being perceived as the Appalachia of the West Coast when it comes to education? I don't know. I can't believe it's good.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Nui, did you want to...
I agree with what my colleagues have to say. I just want to add one thing. Businesses in general do not pay taxes. That is, we'll pass it on to the user or the consumer of the product. So ultimately, to the extent they could. So somebody will have to pay for it. And the idea that somehow is a free lunch that doesn't cause any harm or doesn't deter or doesn't cause prices to rise is simply wrong.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate Mr. Johnson's comments about Oregon's image problems and what we must do quickly and proactively to correct that image. The damage has been done. And I want to point to some testimony that is written and that is before us. It's from Andy Anderson, Cascade Corporation, who was unable to be on the panel, and he does say in his testimony, which is in alignment with Mr. Johnson's comments, and I'm just reading from the testimony and for the record, he says, in my opinion, the legislature must demonstrate strong and courageous leadership in restructuring the state's tax base to provide the necessary funding. By strong and aggressive leadership, I am suggesting that you identify the steps you feel are prudent and necessary, and that you enact them without referendum. I believe you have that mandate and that legal authority. And he goes on to talk about how voters are ready for us to demonstrate leadership, and he says that he personally will appreciate, respect, and support clear, decisive, and forceful action. So again, for the record, I think that just underscores the point that Mr. Johnson is making again about what we must do if we're going to correct that very tarnished image that Oregon is projecting right now to not just the rest of the nation, but to the world.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Winters, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to kind of piggyback that, but also talk about another competition issue, because we're talking about competitiveness not only within other states, because we are in competition with other states for businesses to come in, but also on the flip side of retaining businesses that are currently in the state. And I haven't heard a lot about that, and I'd like some discussion by the panel and what would you do if you were in our position. And I'm from Salem, so I'm specifically looking at such issues where we have lost processing plants. We've lost Chiquita here. We've lost AgPac here. And Sumco is here, and there's some issues with that. And what would you as a policymaker do in order to retain businesses within Oregon? I think we always talk about what we do to bring new businesses in, but I think there's the issue of retaining what we currently have.
Senator Winters, that's a... I have an opinion, but it's not going to be a pleasant opinion. There are some things that you can't do anything about, other things you can do something about. The food processing factories in the Salem area typically were producing vegetables that had a high labor content. A lot of work went into getting the corn off the cob. In contrast, the food processing plants in the Columbia Basin tend to be French fries, which are very automated, hardly a person in the factory. We used to be, of course, we have a great place to grow vegetables. China has great places to grow vegetables. We didn't used to compete with China on frozen vegetables, because you can't make frozen vegetables if you don't have electricity to freeze, or if the electricity is going to go out every third day. But as other less developed countries are getting their acts together, they've got reliable electricity, a lot reliable transportation, they've got cheaper labor. And I see absolutely no way, short of massive subsidies, we could have kept those industries. But at the same time that some industries are going to be leaving, there are going to be others growing, not necessarily recruited from out of state, but just local entrepreneurs starting a business. And so I would say we should focus on our general overall business environment, and we're going to have to accept the fact that there are changes, and some businesses are going to go, some are going to rise. And in this area, there's one thing that I don't think we've mentioned yet that I would like to get on the record, and that is I believe there's a change in business strategy in terms of a preference towards faster action. 10 years ago, it seemed like businesses would decide on something and you'd have a reasonable time frame to do it. I have noticed in my own consulting practice that when a business calls and they want a study done or a presentation to their management team, I get a lot less notice. And it's like, hey, if you can do this in 3 weeks, good. If not, who would you recommend? And I'm an economist. I mentioned this to a friend of mine who's a demolition contractor, sort of at the opposite extreme of whether you sit in the office or whether you do real work. And he's seeing exactly the same thing. Companies sort of dither, sit around, talk about it, but once they make a decision, they want that old building torn down as fast as possible, new stuff put up as fast as possible. And as we think about like our regulatory environment, I would suggest, and I think the governor is right to be thinking along these lines, that instead of saying, gee, we want to dial regulations up or dial regulations down, we should think we want the process to be transparent, so that if a business manager is thinking, could I do this, let's make sure that it's crystal clear whether you can do it. And if it is a permitted activity, make sure you can get that permit in a very short time frame. I think we have in this country moved from the rule of law with cut and dried answers to what's legal and what's not to a rule of judgment, and that has created uncertainty and a lengthening timeline on the regulatory process.
Senator Winters. In terms of retaining existing businesses, I would say the same thing I did about attracting new ones, and that is that it's not the role of government. An economist once said that one of the benefits of the capitalist system is what he called creative destruction. There are businesses that eventually are going to go out of business, and those resources are going to be freed up for other uses. And government is not very good at deciding which ones should be disappearing and which ones shouldn't be. And typically, attempts to change the economic conditions are likely to be inefficient and costly to the economy in the long run. I also wanted to make just one brief comment on Senator Gordley's remarks. Certainly, there is room for increases and stability in the revenue system. The one thing that I often would like to hear from the legislature and very seldom hear are arguments for cost-cutting, for ranking the priority of state services, and for basically looking at ways in which the effectiveness and efficiency of state government is likely to be improved. I think that one of the things that you have to face is that people don't trust you. I hate to say that, but there's a lot of concern that you're not focusing on both issues, that it's not just a question of stability of revenue and more revenue, it's also a question of how effectively you're using the resources that are available, and at least the perception that people have of whether that's being done appropriately.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond,
all right.
I do not disagree with anything you said. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Patrick.
I just have to comment because only where government has placed obstacles in the way, and you talk about permitting systems, and I want to go back to some of the land use systems that actually have put up, whether it's growth or no growth, that has impact on doing business in Oregon. And I do think that government, whether we have realized it or not, have placed in the way of businesses some obstacles that makes it not friendly for individuals to either stay and continue to do business in Oregon or to relocate or to do their business in Oregon. I was here when we had this discussion in the recession in the 80s with Governor Attia. And so I do think we as government do things that do set up some parameters, whether we're talking taxation, whether we're talking land use, and some of those barriers that are there. If I'm competing with other states and I'm looking at the services that they provide and the tax structure and the land availability, I'm going to go, and the educational piece, Jim, I'm going to go where those packages are there.
The issue of regulation or this time to money or the speed, I think, is a very important one. I mean, Oregon has a very, very anti-business perception based on, the fact that they don't view business as a customer, and they basically say, when you come to me, you're on my turf and you live by my rules, as opposed to the business guy who's saying, I have to compete. And so they will go to the places where they're supported. And I think that this issue of getting our regulatory system more transparent, or however it's phrased, I think is very, very important. I mean, it's an issue of predictability. No one wants us to eliminate, we all love Oregon. It's a great, clean state. We're not suggesting that we should have polluters come in or do anything inappropriate. It has to be predictable. And that's what business wants. And so if you say to them, you can get a permit and it will take us, 4 weeks, and you will have an answer, that is a tremendous benefit of what they get now, which is a totally open-ended process. And there are other states that will say, we will give you an answer on this date. And so that whole attitudinal change, I think, is a very important one and would have a big effect on keeping the businesses we have and encouraging more businesses to come.
Representative Patridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had maybe a two-part question. You review all of the policies we set as policymakers and compare them and look at economies not only domestically but internationally. And I'm interested, from the economist's point of view, we have a short-term economic problem then a long-term economic problem for the state, or a long-term economic issue. Can you give me just number one and number two, what you would do short-term, the two things, and what you would do long-term if you'd happen to be sitting in our shoes to stabilize, and assuming growth is good, make the economy grow for the state of Oregon?
Representative Hatcher, I'll jump in on that. Probably shouldn't, but short term, as I said, I think the thing that's frustrated me about the special sessions and about the responses to the fall off in revenue has been a failure to look at prioritization and cost cutting. And I really think that that has not been addressed adequately. And I think, you know, given the revenue forecast for the next biennium, I think it does need to be addressed. And I think, in particular, prioritization of spending is an important role. You need to decide what you want to cut. And there have to be some things that you rank as being low priority that you're going to cut, and make it clear and say we're doing this and publicize it so people know that you're looking not just at revenues but also at what the state spends and how effectively it spends it. In the long term, I think, I don't want to be self-serving, but I think Oregon does not put enough resources into higher education. Not necessarily my part of higher education. I think, you know, as was mentioned earlier, things like engineering and science are the things that are important in terms of long-term growth. We're relatively unsupportive of higher education in this state.
I don't have a lot to add to Tony's short-term suggestion. I don't believe there's anything you can do to get this economy growing rapidly in the short run. I think that all you can do is manage the affairs of the government with the understanding that there are a lot of things out of your control. In the long run, you mentioned international comparisons. There is clear evidence from several surveys that the countries that are doing the best in terms of long-term economic growth provide the greatest respect for property rights and the greatest amount of rule of law, as opposed to rule by judgment and friend cronyism. As we respect property rights and as we respect having a cut-and-dried legal system, we put in place the requirements for the enabling factors for long-term economic growth, and then the private sector will do it on its own.
Representative Partridge, Mr. Chair, I concur. Not much you can do in the short term as policymakers, because you can't print money.
We try.
And you can't deficit financing. So what the right thing to do is, just like most households have to do, you have to cut back. I mean, that's obvious. Now, in the long term, I think we should worry about a comparative advantage, competitiveness with other nations, China, India, so on and so forth. And I think education is part of it. However, I have a different spin than most of my colleagues about, because I believe that we can import talents. You can import that from as a matter of fact, if everything else, if you go by the highest spending in higher education and so on and so forth, then, my goodness, Massachusetts maybe will come out on top. That has not been the case. You can always import talent, is my point. In other words, you do the right thing. You don't want to overspend on one particular segment.
On the issue of short term, I think getting control of your spending, I think, is critical. I think that you don't take advantage of the industries or the business expertise you have around. I can tell you your IT structure, the way you structure your is the most inefficient way you can possibly do it. Yeah. And it will guarantee your highest costs and lowest productivity the way it's currently being done. So are there bad people in your IT group? No. There are very good people who really try, but the way it's structured, they are not in a position to really do a world-class job. So purchasing, I'll guarantee you're probably in the same boat. You've got world-class companies who have learned to compete and do those things a lot better than there's being done here. And I'd be looking at how can we get that expertise and that review into this process so that we can be more effective. I mean, we every day in business say, how can we deliver a better product at a cheaper price and a cheaper cost? And we invest to do that. This government should be doing the exact same thing. So the whole notion with government seems to be that once it's established, it's there forever, and we don't change it. And as opposed to every day we're changing, every day we're getting better, every day. So there's a huge, you need a chief operating officer who's going to come in here and say, we're going to control this thing. And not to reduce one level service. I mean, if you just said we're just going to hold everything, the output's the same, just make them cheaper, there's lots of ways you can be doing that. And that sends a tremendous signal around everywhere. Again, you talk about business. Would business want to do a business in a state in which they see an efficient government, or do they want to do business in a state where they see an inefficient government? It gets down to the issue of value for tax. I think there's a lot of room for efficiencies, but we're not structured to do it. And so, again, I think one of your huge challenges is figure out how to structure this thing to cause more efficiencies. So that's your, and again, I couldn't agree on the long-term one. It's a combination of things, but clearly a strong investment in education and commercialization and of that process, as well as figuring out a way to get capital in this state. Boy, venture capital has run from this state. And if we don't have access to capital, we're going to hurt. There's a whole ecosystem that has to be created around creating new companies. Education is the lead, but it's not the only element. We've got to make that whole thing happen.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you. Very, very briefly, on a short-term basis, the governor has proposed some increase in registration fees so that we could start repairing our interest, borrow money to improve the infrastructure on roads and bridges. We've got significant amounts of capital improvements that we're still talking about in this budget. Do those make sense short term in this environment to be aggressively investing in infrastructure, even if we have to print money to do it at a low interest environment?
Absolutely. Again, just like Doonesbury, the fact that we had to close Highway 5 for trucks, again, that's another signal we're sent out to the world. Don't come to Oregon, we're falling apart.
Administrator,
Just quickly, I don't disagree on the potential beneficial impact of additional infrastructure investment. Unfortunately, the lag time in doing that is such that, you know, historical studies have found that when governments do that, when they're in the bottom of the recession and decide they want to do some additional infrastructure to stimulate the economy, it usually comes online during the peak of the boom. And so I would not expect that it would have a big short-term impact.
Even with a very slow recovery?
I don't expect it to be that slow.
I just wanted to thank our panelists for coming. It's been a very, very good discussion. Everyone's paid attention. It's only the last-minute meetings and lunchtime that are making them go away at this point in time, and they'd stick around, I think, a little longer. And I think it's very clear to me that while we didn't get all the answers we wanted to hear, we got good, sound advice and good thought processes about the volatility of our tax system, about what we can afford to do, what sort of ending balances can we afford or not, what should we be doing, not just now, but to set ourselves up for the future with realizing we will come out of this at some point in time. So I just wanted to thank the panelists very much for coming. It's been a most enlightening discussion.
My thanks as well. We appreciate your time and your information perspective. Very valuable to this committee. Thank you again.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.